All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the ICAT Task Force. Before we get started, I'll do a quick roll call. Cheryl Turney.
Cheryl's here.
Alex Goff.
Present.
Erin Meary. Abby Sears. Alexis Snyder.
Hello.
Hi. Andy Truscott. Anil Jain.
I'm here.
Arian Malik. Deb Strickland. Denise Webb.
Present.
And Gus Jaworski.
I'm here. I'm
Jackie
here.
Monson. Jackie, okay. Jim Jurgis. Jocelyn Keegan. Les Leonard, either Mary Green or Alex Smuggy from CMS. Ram Sharam. Rich Landon.
I'm here.
Sasha Termont.
Hello.
Steve Brown.
Here.
Great. And Dr. Mason indicated he would be absent today, so I will turn it over to our co-chairs.
Again, this is Ram Sriram. I don't know whether you heard it or not. I'm on mute, so I'm here.
Thank you, Ram.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Lauren. I think we can go ahead and advance to the next slide. Thanks for already completing the roll call and welcome. This is Alex Goss, and I'm going to do a little bit of summary and action plan update before we turn it over to our two presenters today. We have AHIMA as well as CAQH Core. Cheryl and I will be tag teaming on handling the questions and answers between those sessions before she wraps us up with sort of our next steps overall. Obviously, we'll take time for a public comment as well. So with that set up on today's agenda, we've got a lot of exciting presentations today to help us advance further thinking around our intersection of clinical and administrative data. But first, let's talk a little about what happened on our last call. You go to the next slide. Thank you. So last week, it was only a week ago, Kathy Shepherd, the executive director of X12, delivered a very robust presentation that helped us understand X12's as a standards development body's multi-industry focus that they've had for over 40 years. Their standards are in use billions of times a day with transactions that are exchanged across the multiple verticals that use the EDI standards. They also shared that there are more than just electronic data interchange standards they use. They have other JSON, XML, and crosswalks vocabularies that will help them exchange information across multiple syntax. As a part of that work, it was really exciting to understand the bifurcated approach that X12 has for their accredited standards committee. Many of us know their work from the HIPAA transactions that were promulgated, but they've also created a registered standards committee, which really helps out with that vocabulary aspects. They produce technical reports, including implementation specifications, and that has been sort of on an as-ready-to-publish sort of approach. And Kathy Shepherd talked about their new ARC annual release cycle. I think that was a very exciting development for us to learn that X12 has been really developing an approach to more of an annual activity, updating of implementation guides and technical reports to be more responsive to the industry sector. With that sort of framing, she led us into some discussions around the prior authorization with their HIPAA implementation guide and their iterative work based upon the business asks within the community, and talked about their sort of perch of disconnects in the 278 world and sort of some questions we might be asking ourselves as we look to try to better meet the efficiency opportunities within the healthcare ecosystem. And she also spoke a little bit to their work in the community working with DaVinci, and to try to improve their overall code lists for clarity, which are several items that we've talked about within the task force arena over the last several months. In addition to Kathy's presentation and the robust Q&A that we had, there was a privacy and security guiding principles and ideal state presentation, bringing back the work from that small group, rounding out the prior work that we had done in regards to the overarching ideal state and guiding principles. We wrapped up the session with a discussion around timing and updates that will be forthcoming from some of our small working groups. We have some on data classes, business process modeling. We've wrapped up the guiding principles and ideal state work, and that's pivoted into our recommendations discussion. We also talked about the report that we're queuing up to work on over the summer to make our Labor Day delivery to HITAC. So we have a lot of timelines and goals over the July and August timeframe to get there. So we're going to be wrapping up this week a couple more presentations, and then we'll continue down the path of wrapping up prior authorization before we get into the intersection, more global conversation and what that means for our report. So it was a pretty action-packed meeting, and I thank everybody for their involvement in those presentations and discussions. I hope you'll do so again today as we now pivot to our first presentation from AHIMA. I think we're about ready to invite Lauren and her team to come into the fold and share their presentation, and then I'll facilitate their Q&A before we wrap and move to the next presentation. Cheryl, with that set up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think you said it all. Thanks, Alex.
You're welcome, Cheryl. So if we're ready to turn it over, Katie, to Lauren, I think we can pivot to her slide deck. I'm really excited to hear from AHIMA. So thank you, Lauren. Why don't you take it away?
Excellent. Thank you, Alex, and thank you all for this opportunity to present to you all today. Next slide, please. So as Alex mentioned, first of all, I'm the Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs for the American Health Information Management Association. And today what we really wanted to present to you all was just first to kind of provide, I'll provide an overview of AHIMA itself. And then I'll ask Allison Nicholas, who's joined us today, is also an AHIMA member, to talk a little bit about and provide an overview of Trinity Health. And then in coordination with Chantal Warzala, also provide really the operational picture, kind of the meat of this presentation. So next slide, please. So as many of you all may or may not know, AHIMA is a global organization that represents health information professionals that work with health data for more than a billion patients a year. Our mission is to empower people to impact health, and our vision is a world where trusted information transforms health and healthcare by connecting people, systems, and ideas. Next slide, please. So one of the core tenets of our organization and as a profession is that we believe that health information is human information. So in other words, what that means is that AHIMA certified professionals hold an intimate relationship with health information. And even though patients may not always necessarily see us, we see many patients in ways that no other health professional necessarily does. And what that means is, you know, we see that person connected to the data, and we need to ensure that that health information stays human, because when the information stays human, it stays relevant. Next slide, please. I'm not sure on my end, it's a little slow. So has the slide deck advanced for other folks?
Yes. Yes, I'm seeing AHIMA's role in coding.
Perfect. Okay, then we can keep going.
Okay,
so one
awesome.
Of the things we're most well known for is really our role in coding. So as many of you all know, we are one of the designated cooperating parties for ICD-10 coding guidance. We share that responsibility with CMS as well as the National Center for Health Statistics and the American Hospital Association. But beyond that, you know, we participate in a variety of coding usage and standardization activities, both not only in the U.S., but overseas and internationally as well. We also serve as the preeminent source of coding education and professional education. And this is a responsibility that we really take seriously. And so for that reason, we are an organization that has developed the standards of ethical coding that we ask our members to abide by, because we believe so strongly in our role in this coding world. One of the things I think for purposes of this discussion today that I often share with folks is that what's interesting about AHIMA and its members is that we sit at this intersection of clinical and administrative data, in that many of our members' role is to translate that clinical data for standardized administrative data transactions. And our core focus is really to ensure the correctness of those claims and to keep them flowing to really sustain the revenue cycle. And it's really because of this expertise and at being at this intersection that we're really happy to serve as a resource to you all in this area. So I'm going to turn it over to Allison to talk a little bit about Trinity Health and kind of what she sees on an on-the-ground perspective in regards to this issue.
Thanks, Lauren. So if you would go to the next slide. As mentioned, my name is Allison Nicholas. I'm the Regional Director of HIM Services for Trinity Health of New England, and I'm part of Trinity Health as a system. As you can see on the slide, Trinity Health is a national Catholic health system. There are 92 hospitals in 22 states. Our region has 4 acute care hospitals, 2 rehabs, and 2 psych units, along with multiple physician practices and continuing care locations. So some of my background that I'm sharing here is to help you understand where I'm coming from when I discuss the next oncoming slide. So if you could go to the next slide. Our mission as a faith-based organization is to serve together in the spirit of the gospel as a compassionate and transforming healing presence within our community. We are daily reminded as employees of the importance of living our core values, which include reverence, justice, commitment to those who are poor, stewardship, safety, integrity. And all of these values, I feel, are really important to be considered when we're working with the current environment where our health models are constantly changing. If you could go to the next slide. As outlined on this slide, we are in a time of continued change. We see customers, consumers, patients who are actively accessing and interacting with their own personal health information, while we as providers and insurers or payers are moving from a fee-for-service to a value and outcome-based reimbursement model. AHIMA believes that health information is the most powerful currency for change in this healthcare ecosystem. Information that will require combining our revenue cycle or reimbursement models with quality data. And we rely heavily on the use of clinical decision support within each of our organizations, along with machine learning, to navigate through these changing times. If you could go to the next slide. What's really important for you to understand, AHIMA is very focused on clinical documentation integrity. We see the clinical documentation as a fundamental core of every one of our patient encounters. The information has to be documented completely. It has to be accurate, and it really has to be timely to reflect the full scope of services that we provide, and to ensure that all parties involved in the healthcare arena, from the patient to the provider to the payer, are able to make the best decisions with regard to the services provided and the appropriate reimbursement for those services. This information is shared in both a textual and a coded format, which is what Lauren was sharing with before about the use of codes, the ICD-10 coding system. The textual is so that the providers and the patients are able to communicate in a way that everybody understands, but the coded information has to be accurate as well, so everyone across the continuum and across the country is speaking the same language. So if you could go to the next slide. So the full scope of information gathering and use is broad, as noted earlier. On this slide, what we're trying to show is that there are three major touch points in which there's sharing of clinical data and administrative data with the payers. So we'll call them three swim lanes. The first swim lane or touch point is before we even provide a service. And I heard earlier there was a discussion about prior authorization. This is where that step comes into. Prior to doing a service, payer rules and employer plans will require providers to be aware of when a prior authorization is required and to notify the payer of any planned encounter to ensure that the service and the level of care being considered are covered by the plan and to make sure that it's in the right location. Is it appropriate to do the service as an outpatient or an inpatient? Should it be an observation status? In addition, we do prior authorizations at the point of discharge because it's prior to services that may be needed after the patient leaves that provider or facility. So it could be rehab, it could be home health, it could be any number of different areas that would need to continue care with the patient. The second swim lane that we are looking at here where we're sharing information is known as concurrent review process. At this stage, and generally this is for inpatient services, there is a communication between the payer and the provider to ensure that the patient is being cared for in the most appropriate setting. And we call that utilization review services. So we have a team of people that review records concurrently and discuss the information with the payers to make sure the patient really should be at the level of care they're at. In addition, the provider is helping to prepare the patient for their continued self or assisted care post-discharge, and we have a team at that point, their case managers, that work with external organizations to evaluate the level of care that is required for these patients, and they have to do that by determining the acuity of illness that they have. And then the third lane or swim lane is the post-discharge process. And this is where we see a large amount of information being shared back and forth between providers and third parties. So payers and quality organizations are reviewing data for many reasons. They confirmed that the documentation supported the service that was actually authorized, that the care was appropriate, and determined the quality of services. At this step, they are also looking for information to support the coding and the reimbursement that's being provided for that service. So it can involve requests for specific documents from a single patient encounter. They could also request an entire record for a single encounter. But on top of that, what we will also see is requests from third parties where they're asking for many records, sometimes as many as 200 or 300 at a time, where they're looking at a large number of patient request records to determine whether or not the payment is appropriate. This is through or for risk adjustment or HEDIS measures, and on occasion they even request records if there's a patient complaint or they need to review something specific. What underlies all of these reviews is that all parties involved have to be aware of the ethical obligations in managing the patient's personal health information. So are we following HIPAA requirements while simultaneously ensuring that there is ease of access? So from a privacy and security perspective, we need as a provider to ensure that the request and the requester are allowed to have the access that they are looking for. From an accuracy perspective, we have to make sure that the documentation that we are sending out is complete and accurately reflects the services that were provided. For accessibility, we have to make sure that the data is accessible in the form and the format that's being requested by that third party. We also have to ensure that the integrity of the provision of that information is there. So if it's being sent multiple formats, we need to make sure that the data is secure. And then we also have to make sure that the disclosure is appropriate. So is the information limited to what is minimally necessary for the purpose of the request? So the next slide. The dilemma that we find we're facing is how best to manage the sharing of the data for the various clinical and administrative purposes that rely on the information. Unlike the paper environment, and I've been doing this for over 40 years, where I was really looking forward to an electronic health record, in the paper environment, it was very easy to provide the information that was being requested because the paper clearly identifies a specific document, clearly identifies the author of every entry, and in the electronic health record system, the data is actually collected as data elements. While a provider is documenting, the provider sees a screen that looks like a form you might see in a paper record. But to reproduce that documentation requires the development of reports by IT to pull the specific data elements into a format that can be read easily by the recipient. And that's going to be based on the specific information that's being requested by that third party. For certain types of requests, the electronic record system has a way of templating reports. So we could say that anytime a provider is looking for just a discharge summary and a history and physical, we can very quickly provide that through that template. But many of the requests that are received are for special reports that have to be designed to ensure that the data that is being requested or required to perform the functions that the requester is trying to get done is included, and that can create difficulty. The content is generally payer or requester driven, and it can depend on the event that triggered the request. It's required to support a service that will often change when the coverage rules change or for other reasons, often without notice to those that are reproducing the information. And because of that, as the requests come in, we may find ourselves having to scramble to write a report to send specifically what that requester is asking for. The providers must also be prepared to produce the data in the form and format requested. We have 30 third parties that ask for paper. They ask for information to be backed electronically or by paper. They may ask for a CD. They may ask for a thumb drive. They may have a portal that we upload the data to, and some are asking for direct access into our electronic systems. Each of the methods that they're requesting access through require different equipment or technology and can create barriers for that ease of access and responding within required timeframes. So as health models continue to change, and the requests for information are increasing in both frequency and scope, they all need to be considered as the healthcare system is moving forward. So I'll turn the presentation now over to Chantel.
Great. Thanks so much, Allison. My name is Chantel Warzala, and I'm a consultant working with AHIMA. As Allison so eloquently shared, the data flows that are supporting administrative transactions are really just one piece of the picture. So if we think about automating prior auth, that's super important, but there are a lot of other issues to be addressed if we really want to be taking friction out of the system for patients, for providers, and for payers. So if you go two slides, I forgot to say next slide, here are some of the other aspects that composed some barriers to greater integration of clinical and administrative health data and may point to some of the policy considerations for the task force recommendations. So first is that lack of standardization for business processes. Is there a way to harmonize plan rules for the data that's being asked for and when it's being asked for? Tremendous variability, as Allison was speaking to. And there really needs to be a little more predictability and definitely notice if criteria change. So from a policy perspective, I'm wondering if there's a way for providers and payers to work together on a process that might lead to better standardization and predictability. I know you're hearing from CAQH Core today, so we have in the past seen policy support for creation of operating rules. So that's one thought. Then there are obviously the operational issues. If we think about having a new automation, how would that fit into today's workflow? And what if you think about just the case of authorizations, how will that affect what happens on the clinician side for the physicians and the nurses at the point of care? And what will the impact be for back office functions, such as those many AHIMA members take care of? And then how do the systems that are being used today change? This is really an area where AHIMA members are on the ground and can potentially serve as a resource. In addition, of course, administrative transactions are flowing through a significant existing infrastructure. We've got the whole revenue cycle to think about, and as we contemplate changes, it really will be important to minimize disruption to the revenue cycle. And I think Alex might have said in her introductory remarks, we have more than 3 billion claims that are filed and adjudicated electronically each year. So that's a lot to think about. Then on technical issues, of course, there will be shifting IT needs and investments that will need to be made. And so we need to think about whether providers will actually have affordable solutions that work in the real world. There's also that challenge of the time and scale of deployment. So if you're a provider working with multiple health plans, is everyone shifting to more automated approaches at the same time? Are you going to end up with this mixed model still of sending data to different places in different formats? So some consideration to timing and scale of transformation might be interesting. And then we have implications for the workforce. As we really move forward here, there may be shifts in needed capabilities. Folks may need training on new standards, on new technologies, and new processes. And over time, there may indeed be a significant workforce realignment. So this may be an area where policymakers should support greater understanding of potential impacts. Then this question of the alignment and the accuracy of the vocabulary standards themselves, it's a little bit geeky, but this is a geeky crowd. So if you think about your clinical systems and your administrative systems, they actually can rely on different vocabulary standards for the same concept. So think about the difference of SNOMED being embedded in an EHR and ICD-10 being the basis of at least inpatient claims and outpatient diagnoses. So right now, we do lack a consensus-based map to go between and translate across these standards. There are mappings embedded in a lot of products, but they're generally unique and can be proprietary. So we don't know a whole lot about them, which raises the question of whether we need a single national mapping, for example. Some of the other issues here, data integrity, and how does the lack of a patient matching solution lend itself or not create issues for data integrity. Know you're taking on privacy and security, which are clearly big issues. Providers take their responsibility to protect the confidentiality of sensitive information very seriously. And think long and hard about that issue of limiting sharing of information to that which is the minimum necessary for a given purpose, such as adjudicating payment. And of course, we have the security challenges and trust. I just end here on trust. Data moves at the speed of trust, as they say, and there are concerns that clinical data shared for one purpose could potentially be reused for other purposes, that negatively affect individuals or impact the relationship between providers and payers. And so ensuring that we're moving forward in a way that there is trust among all parties will be very important. And really one way to build trust is participation. So if we can make sure that all parties are part of this conversation, that really will help to ensure that the operational and trust issues are addressed. And to that end, I've got to say, I really appreciate the broad representation on this task force and the wide net you've cast in seeking input. So let me stop there so that we have some time for Q&A.
Thank you, Chantal. This is Alex Goss. A terrific presentation by the team here today. I'd like to call upon our members to raise their hand should they want to get in the queue to ask questions of our presenters. Taking a look to see if any are coming up while I wait to see those hands raised. I did want to ask you a little bit more about the vocabulary issue, and you talked about on slide 19, maybe we can go back to that because I think it's a kind of an interesting list. Having worked with the recommendations team just a couple hours ago, I was sort of feeling like you, Ahima may have been cued in on some of the threads that we were having, and one aspect we were talking about was the data capture and how that works. And I think about this vocabulary aspect that you mentioned on this slide with the mapping. And so I guess I have kind of a two-pronged question to the Ahima team around the, I'd like to hear a little bit more of your thoughts about this national, one single national mapping of vocabularies. And the other part I'd like to hear related to that is sort of the, how does that work with the boots on the ground data capture with the, in the electronic health records a national mapping. Like, I'm curious about the challenges clinicians have with putting data into their EHR and what that means to you as you're moving forward and actually getting a health information request that you need to fulfill and ultimately trying to get to that end state mapping that somebody can actually not only have the medium in which they can consume the export you give them, but also to interpret it correctly.
Lauren, this is Chantal. You want me to take that?
Yeah, that'd be great, Chantal.
Yeah, so I think the challenge here is, you know, we've had our EHR systems growing up through one set of standards and our administrative systems growing up through another set of standards. And so the prominence of ICD-10 versus SNOMED is an interesting aspect of this, and if we start to think about, well, can we just pull stuff from the electronic health record to populate something that might be used for an administrative purpose, we have this question of how are those vocabularies working together? And I think this is really something that will require some investigation in just really answering some of your questions. I don't think we have all the answers. But it is, you know, a place where we see there's a lot of expertise built up in the world of ICD-10 and how do you look at a full medical record to understand what is the best code to assign versus thinking about are we moving toward an automation where you would map it. And so I think there are a lot of questions there. And also, honestly, I don't know how much we know about your question, which is when a physician is developing a problem list and picking among SNOMED codes, what is that process? And how do we know really the fidelity of the SNOMED codes that are in the EHR today?
I really appreciate this. So there's a focus around ICD-10 and something we probably should get our arms around, especially as we think about the fact that ICD-11 is in the works and on our horizon in the next 5 to 10 years, something for us to be thinking about, and that the national mapping. I know there's been a lot of work. The NCVHS recently did an environmental scan of terminologies and vocabularies, and so there's some really great work available on the NCVHS website related to that, and there's been a lot of investment in years gone by with the United States Health Information Knowledge Base, or USHIC. So I think that there's something for us to think about that as we explore our data classes and data categories discussion, which I think we're going to be diving into more on next week's call. So I appreciate sort of the elevating that awareness in our thinking. I'm not seeing any other hands up. I know we're slated to pivot here in a minute to our next presenter, but I'm curious as to this trigger event conversation, and if there's any other thoughts you might like to add about that, because you know the triggers are really critical. I think that was back on slide 16. If we could skim back, roll back to that slide, I'd appreciate that. It'd be three slides back. This is a really interesting slide, and I like the way the swim lanes approach. I think Allison was describing this. I'm really helping. I mean, there's a lot of different business processes or specific threads that are being handled in all of these swim lanes with probably a pretty common set of data, one Uber set of data that is used as applicable with each one of these threads. So do you have any commentary about sort of the data aspect and the triggers that maybe we should be thinking about as we move forward with how to make it better from a provider burden perspective?
Yes, so this is Allison. If I could speak to that, Chantel and Lauren. It's one of the things that we deal with every single day. And as I mentioned, the payers have different rules, and the knowledge base, I think Chantel touched on that, is how do we have staff that know exactly what each of the payers need at each point in this swim lane process. So for prior authorizations, you will see a certain group that are looking for very key information to approve a stay that's happening. During the concurrent review process, there are different people touching from both the provider side and the payer side. So they're looking for a different set of information that could overlap with that prior authorization. And then on the discharge side, again, you have a different set of people from both the provider and the payer base. And there are times, you know, I have to say from a personal perspective, I just think we should just give all payers all the records so they can get all the information they need in one place, and they're not asking for information at different stages of the game that might look different. So, you know, it triggers are not just these prior authorizations, concurrent review, and post-discharge, but also the internal workings of both the provider and the payer in terms of communicating information for services that are being provided. So I don't know if that answered your question, but hoping
it did. It actually gave me something to think about, which is not only that inter-exchange, but the intra-processes that have to go into play, something we need to be thinking about in our sort of global thinking around the business process model. So a very good response. Thank you for that very much. Terrific presentation. A lot of good content for us to think about. We'll be adding hopefully your presentation to our compendium, and it'll help us, as I said, advance our body of work. It already sort of helped crystallize a few things we were talking about earlier today in some small working group meetings. So thanks again. And at this point, I think I'm going to turn it over probably Cheryl and April.
Thank you, Alex. So yes, what we have next is we have a CAQH core and April Todd, who is going to be providing a presentation, and I'll help facilitate the questions at the end. So April, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you all for having us here today. We have a a lot of information to share with you, and I've also included some resources in the back in the appendix as well, particularly a few white papers that we've written on the topics we'll talk about today that provide some more detail, as well as some specifics on some of the operating rules that we have recently passed and submitted to NCDHS, the actual detailed language itself, if you're interested in reading that. But before we do that and start into talking about some of the things we have been working on, I wanted to give this group just a brief background on what CAQH Core is, what we do. So if we could move to the next slide, please. So CAQH Core, we are very proud to be an industry-led multi-stakeholder organization. Our participants include providers, health plans, vendors, government entities, associations, standard-setting organizations, and really represent the vast majority of the industry that we are working with. And what we do with these participating organizations is to create operating rules, which are essentially those business rules that support use of the standards. And what I mean support use of the standards, it support a consistent, standardized, common expectation of how standards will be used. And when we talk about standards, we are standards agnostic. These are business rules that should support the broad use of standards and the intersection and connection of standards that we see as being more necessary as there is a need to connect clinical and administrative data more now than has been in the past. Based on the work we have done in the past, we are designated by the Department of Health and Human Services as the National Operating Rule Author for the HIPAA transactions, and I'll go over in a little bit which ones those cover that we have worked on and are currently working on. And, as I mentioned before, we work on these operating rules through a process working with our stakeholders across the industry to develop those rule sets that can be brought to NCDHS first and then HHS for consideration for federal mandate. On the next slide, just wanted to provide a very brief understanding or a brief description of what an operating rule is. An operating rule, as I mentioned before, that's the business rules that help with the exchange of electronic information. And to give you an example of that, in healthcare, for example, I think one of the most common transactions that is exchanged today is the 270-271 eligibility request and response. Through surveys that we do through the index, that is by far the highest volume transaction that exists. When that transaction first started to be used by the industry, there was a lot of variation in how it was used, and providers were needing to engage with the plans on that transaction in multiple different ways. There were different ways that the plans were using that. And so the industry came together and asked us to help work to standardize that. So one of the first operating rules that we put together was an operating rule that when you use the eligibility transaction, that it specified what financial information needed to come back about the patient, including the copay and deductible, and then it come back in real time. So that's one of the things that helped to standardize the transaction. And since that operating rule is in effect, that the volume of that transaction has gone up significantly over time. The use of business rules is not just specific to healthcare. It's been used in the financial services industry for a long time. And think about, for example, one of the organizations we work with closely, NACHA, has developed operating rules, for example, that help with the use of electronic payments. Operating rules also make it possible for people to use their cash card all across the world in similar ways across various different banks. So business rules are one of those things that really help to standardize use of electronic systems. One of the things I want to specify, though, that operating rules does not do, that I know that this task force has talked about a bit, is that operating rules are not designed to specify whether or how a payer or provider structures a business process. For example, operating rules would not specify when or how a prior authorization was used by a health plan. But if a prior authorization was used, what the operating rules specify is how that information is electronically exchanged. So I just wanted to make that very clear point there. If we can go to the next slide, this is a high-level overview of CORE's operating rules. We have them structured by different business process. The operating rules themselves include things related to infrastructure. So these are things like system availability, use of acknowledgments, companion guides, response times. Also includes information about data content. So within the standards, there's often a lot of flexibility and the ability to communicate various different types of data content. What the operating rules do are specify what must be communicated and how it is communicated, so that there's a common expectation of that baseline that plans and providers can expect. There's also operating rules that we do in other areas. We have done rules, for example, related to web portals to help them become more standardized related to prior authorization, even though that isn't something that our participating organizations recommend as a long-term solution. It is something that can help in the near term. And then we also have rules around connectivity, which I'll talk about a little later. And those rules around connectivity have to do with security, authentication, metadata, and message envelopes for how information can be communicated. And then specifically a little later on, I'll describe how we are currently working on updating those rules to help with the exchange of clinical administrative data and the need to interact between some existing and emerging standards. But now going specifically into prior authorization, if you can go to the next slide. One of the things that CQH does is we do an index report every year where we survey plans and providers to gauge the adoption of electronic transactions across the industry. And for a number of years, prior authorization has been very low in terms of the adoption of the electronic standard. And we've had some, definitely more use of portals and manual submission as well. And what I'll describe, if we can go on to the next slide, is what we have learned as to why that exists. What are the barriers to adoption of electronic prior authorization? And there's a number of them that we have heard in a variety of the work products that we have worked on. One of them, and kind of the key one that drove our board to want to focus on data content rules for the 278, is that there's a lot of inconsistency in the use of the data content in across the industry when communicating the 278, and a lack of understanding of how it could be used. And so what had happened in the industry is that that health plans, when they got a request for a prior authorization, were just immediately pending it, and not much else happened after that. And so it required a provider to call in to figure out, well, what do I do next? What do I need to send you? And so there's a lot of manual work that came after that. Another barrier that we hear a lot, very frequently, is that the lack of a federally mandated attachment standard to communicate the clinical information that needs to go with prior authorization is a big reason for why the 278 is not adopted and why it's very manual. Also, the lack of integration between clinical and administrative systems, they don't talk to each other very easily. Limited availability of vendor products that support the 278. There's a very limited number of that. We had done a survey previously through the index that showed that only 12% of vendors were offering that, as opposed to between 74 and 91% offering the other transactions. So there's just a lack of availability there. Often for providers, it's offered as an add-on, and it's an expensive add-on to include that. We also, in the research that we've done and heard from some of our participants, is that there are state requirements for manual intervention. And what I mean for that related to prior authorization is that a number of states require that if there is going to be a denial of a prior authorization, that the health plan needs to send a letter to the provider, needs to send a letter to the patient. There's also a number of states that require a peer-to-peer phone conversation that occurs if there would be an adverse determination or a recommendation for a different type of care alternative that exists. And so there are some things there that are just requirements that exist. There is also a lack of understanding of the 278 in general, in particular by providers, and providers not knowing that it is the mandated standard and that if they ask for it, the plans need to be able to conduct that transaction. And then just various levels of maturity along the standards and adoption curve related to prior authorization. There are some organizations that are way ahead of the curve and are doing a lot in this space, and there are others that everything is manual. And so there is a wide variability in the industry on that. If we can go to the next slide, I wanted to highlight a few things to talk about in this presentation. And there's probably more content here than I'll go through, but also wanted for you all to have it as reference, are the five different things that we are doing right now related to prior authorization that I think have a strong connection to the work that you guys are doing around administrative and clinical data. One is data content related to prior authorization. I'll talk about that briefly. Second is once we've established consistent data content, we have rules that establish consistent infrastructure and timeframes for communicating that information. We also have rules around connectivity, modes of data exchange, and creating some consistency there. And as I mentioned before, we have a baseline set of rules that we have submitted to NCDHS. We are in the process of updating those specifically to help with the communication of clinical information. Fourth, we are also working on operating rules related to attachments and exchange of clinical information. That work will be starting in our work groups this summer. And then lastly, we have also been working on pilots for the work that we're doing. And we're doing pilots for a couple of different reasons. One is to test some of the new operating rules, how they're working, what is the ROI, but also to test and evaluate additional areas that we could be working on and where there may be a need for additional operating rules in the future. So to go through these five areas very briefly, first is related to the data content related to prior authorization. These are the operating rules that we have recently passed and submitted to NCDHS. So our data content rules require a number of things to help address kind of one of the most significant problem areas for prior authorization. And this is where the provider submits a request and the plan just sends back append. And there's no additional information. The provider needs to get on the phone. Usually what happens, what we hear, is the provider gets on the phone, calls and says, hey, I submitted this request. Did you get it? What do I need to give you? What do I need to do next? Or they will download the entire patient's record and fax it to the health plan so that the health plan has everything they need, they think, to make a determination. So what the data content rules do to help address that are the following, a few key things. One is to create consistent patient identification and verification requirements. The second is to require the return of specific error codes and action codes when a specific error is detected on the request from the provider. This is a very frequent reason why a prior authorization is denied, is just because there are errors and omissions in the submission. There's also a requirement for return of specific healthcare decision reason codes to provide an explanation to the provider as to what needs to happen next and what the status is. We've also required use of specific codes, including blank codes, to provide clear direction both on the status and what is needed. So it will say, you know, a lab, you need to send us a lab result, for example. And then there's also the requirement to display the code descriptions to reduce the burden of interpretation from the provider as well. And In terms of future opportunities, how we've set up these operating rules is to make sure that the data content that underlies them is something that is evergreen. And regardless of whether the version of the X12 standard increases from 5010 to 6, increases, or whether there could be a change in use of standard, that underlying data content, there's a common expectation of what it is that should be communicated back and forth. So we can go to the next slide. So the next slide, this is the second set of rules that we worked on after data content, and the purpose of this rule was to create common expectations around the time frames to be communicating this data content between plans and providers. This, I would say, is one of the most challenging operating rules we have done as an organization. In the research that we did leading up to this, there are ranging across the states. There are 30 different states that have requirements for response times for prior authorization, and they range from 2 days to 15 days. And there's a lot of variability on the applicability of the timeframes, when the clock starts ticking. But in general, the most common thing we found was 2 or 3 business days. And so we worked with our participating organizations to come up with these specific response time rules, which includes the following. One is that when a provider submits a request, the plan would need to respond within 2 business days to describe the status, to either approve it or to ask for additional documentation. And once the plan has received that, any additional documentation that they need back, they have an additional 2 days to provide a final determination to that provider for that request. There's also the optional closeout that a plan can close out the request if they don't receive information back from the provider within 15 business days. They don't need to use that, but they can. One of the requirements is that 90% of the time that these maximum response times be complied with. And so those are the components of those rules. And one of the things that I wanted to comment here is I know there's been a lot of discussion around a focus on real-time prior authorizations. And we've had those conversations in our groups as well. And I think there's a number of reasons why we have heard that this is challenging for the industry to do right now. One of them is around system interactions. So when a request comes in to a plan, they're not just looking at that request alone. They're looking at it in combination with eligibility information, provider network information, and their claims. And claims are often not done in real time. And so they're checking that information for, is this something that we should approve based on the benefit plan, based on the clinical needs of that. There's also the documentation submission. The documentation submission or access to that without an attachment standard, much of that is very manual. And so they're taking the time to do that. Even if the information is coming in quickly, oftentimes there's a need for clinical review. So, they have clinicians that are reviewing that information and at times would be communicating back care alternatives that might be maybe more cost effective, for example. So there are a variety of things that we have heard why real-time is challenging at the moment. But in terms of future opportunities, as we can get in these baseline standards on data content and on response times, hope to improve those over time, particularly as we have rules and standards that can help with the exchange of clinical information or attachments. So you can go to the next slide. Another area that we have submitted operating rules to NCDHS for review is also for our connectivity operating rules. And connectivity operating rules, these are things that specify they specify how data can be exchanged. They establish consistent message envelope, security, authentication standards that are there, and the rules that we have submitted are the most up to date that our participants have worked on. However, we are working on an update to these connectivity rules that would help to support the exchange of clinical information and the intersection with clinical and administrative information. And in particular, we are working on operating rules for the use of REST and APIs, working on real-time and batch message interaction to support attachments, as well as authorization standards using OAuth. And I would just highlight that we will be holding a webinar on July 22nd with Bob Bowman from CORE and one of our co-chairs, Patrick Murda from Humana, that will be going through more detail on these requirements and what the group is working on. We can go to the next slide. Actually, if we could go to slide 12. Slide 11 is more background for you all. We can save some time there and go to slide 12. For slide 12, this describes the work that we are starting to do around attachments, and specifically we have a group that is starting in July that will be working on rules to support the exchange of clinical information. We'll be starting with prior authorization and then moving on to claims. And our initial focus is going to be looking at how to help support the complete adjudication of a prior authorization using either the 275 or this HL7 CCDA. And there are a number of requirements that could be included in here as well, including reassociation requirements between the request and the documentation that's been sent, use of specific code sets, to enable the conversation that goes back and forth related to prior authorization, specifically the use of MOINT codes, as well as aligning with some of the work that ONC has been doing around the USCDI. And so there's a number of things that we are doing in this space as well that can help support that work and hopefully tie into a attachment standard that we hear is forthcoming out of CMS. And then one of the last things I wanted to cover on the next slide, if we can go to that, is the work that we are doing around our pilots. Late last year, we started to work to identify partners within the industry, plans, providers, vendors, to start to test some of the new operating rules that that had been passed, as well as to test some need for additional operating rules to support the entire workflow for prior authorization. And we had been making some great progress with that, and then COVID-19 hit, and we are in a bit of a pause on that at the moment, just because there's a very limited number of prior authorizations that are actually occurring in the market today. But we do have, we are looking forward to being able to share some initial pilot results in August based on some quantitative data that was collected before the start of COVID-19, as well as some qualitative provider experience as well. And what you can see on this slide are some of the metrics that we are working with those organizations to help collect information on some of the ROI and the benefits associated with different operating rules that are there. So lastly, I think I will close up probably with slide 14 and 15 here, if we can go on to the next slide, and just talk a bit about kind of how the rules that we've passed today kind of will help improve automation of prior authorization. So if we think about the workflow process of what exists here, you think about a provider populating or sending in the 278 request to a health plan. You know, previously they would send that and just get append. How this process will now work with the operating rules is that the provider has specific information requirements to send in information about the parent, about the patient, about the provider, the service that's being requested, and they know they know that there will be system availability and connectivity requirements to get that request there. They also know, the providers will know, that once the plan receives that, that they need to respond within a specific amount of time back to the provider, not just telling them that they got it, but what additional information is needed and if there's any errors that they need to correct. The health plan, when they respond back, are going to respond back with very specific information on what is needed, what codes are communicated to send in that specific information that will come back to the provider. Once the provider receives that information back, they'll have more detailed information on the requirements, the display of those codes to understand what they mean, so they can then respond back more quickly with that information. And then they also know that the provider knows when they send that information back that's specifically been requested, that there is a specific time frame with which they will get a response back. And so that's just at a very high level how the rules will help streamline a process that has been very manual to date. And so then I'll just close up with the last slide here that just gives a visual as to the different things that we've been working on over time, and hopefully you'll see how all of these things build upon each other, and we're looking to take a stepwise approach to get the industry to start to adopt some of these requirements and build on those to over time improve the automation of the prior authorization process. So with that, I will stop for any questions.
Thank you, April. I do see a couple hands raised, so we'll start the questions with Rich Landon.
April, thanks for the presentation. I've got a couple of comments and then a question. First comment is you've mentioned, but I want to just specifically call out that the NCBHS Committee on or Subcommittee on Standards is holding a hearing this August 25th and 26th for the purpose of hearing from CAQH and CORE and from the industry on the value of making the prior auth and connectivity rules, the version specified in your slides, as national mandate under the through the CMS regulatory process under HIPAA and ACA. So another comment on that, in today's Federal Register, the notice of that hearing was published. So for those of you who want to see the details of the hearing, today's Federal Register has it. Second comment is just to make sure that the task force members have it clear that in her slides today, April was talking about a couple of different versions of the prior auth, and there is one version that is up for NCBHS consideration as for recommendations for adoption as a national mandate. And then her slide went on to say there are further developments going on toward a future version. I just want to make sure that distinction is clear. They were clearly labeled on the slides, but I wanted to call that out. And now the question, April, and all the work that CORE and its members have done on this, are you seeing any areas of prior auth that are either more conducive for automating with the, you know, given the state of the art, or areas of prior auth that are less conducive for an automated solution at this point in time?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I can say is that in the conversations that we have had with our participating organizations that are interested in working with us on the pilots, is that there is a lot of interest in particular on imaging. There is a feeling, I think, a feeling in two directions. One is that that's something that people are readily interested in doing that could maybe be more easily done, and that we could see a quick return in terms of the ROI. In terms of things that may be a bit more challenging, and this is maybe just a more broad comment based on some of the comments from the working groups, is that whenever there is a substantial amount of clinical documentation that needs to be submitted that is not something that can be codified, easily codified, or something that that needs to be reviewed. Those are the things where I think it will be more challenging, and where there I think is a lot of interest in trying to find a way to create some level of standardization, at least in terms of how that information is communicated.
Thank you very much. We also have a question for Jocelyn Keegan. Jocelyn.
Hi, Jocelyn here. Thank you so much. April, this is great. I really like the way you lay out all of the complications in a clean way. So I appreciate that you guys are working hard to do that. I think my question overall was, I didn't realize you were doing piloting, and I'd love to understand if the people that are participating in the pilots are public. I think it'd be really interesting to get feedback from folks sort of mid-pilot, or if there's any interim findings that are happening from the piloting work, having sort of lived and breathed 278 implementation in my past lives.
Yes, so we are working on that as we speak. We are hoping to have that to be able to share in August by the time of the hearing.
Awesome, thanks.
Thank you, and I don't see any of the hands raised, but I do have a question. So, and maybe this is going to show my ignorance, but I do know that there was some work going on with between DaVinci and I thought it was your group, wrapping the 278 in a transaction. Are you guys involved directly in that, or is that more focused from the HL7 perspective?
I think you're probably referring maybe to something that Kathy had mentioned last week around the mapping that had been occurring between DaVinci and X12 around some of the data elements between the two standards. We've been consulted on that at a distance, but not heavily involved in that effort.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Because I didn't see it in your deck, and so that's why I was wondering, because I thought maybe you guys were more involved in that. Any other questions from the group? I don't see any more hands raised at this moment. I really thank you for your presentation. It was very helpful, and especially I think, as others pointed out, the diagrams were very, very helpful in terms of understanding exactly what was in the rule. I did spend the weekend reviewing the proposed rules, and these figures that you have are very helpful.
Thank you.
Well, if we have no more questions, I guess what we're going to move to now is maybe we'll do a little bit of an early open of the line for public comment, and then we can always come back and see if we get further questions.
Great. Thanks, Cheryl. We're just pulling up the phone number now, and we'll ask the operator to open the public line.
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your headset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments. We have no comments at this time.
Okay, wonderful. Then why don't we, and I don't see any more hands raised while we're waiting, and it's a lot of material that both groups went over today, so there is a potential that people will have questions after, but hopefully we will be able to follow up because we do have the contact information. Why don't we put up the next slide, and we'll do a little recap, and may give people a few minutes back in their day. But for this group, just so you understand, there is small team working going on, working on the recommendations that we're going to be presenting in the next couple of weeks, and also the process model. So next week, we're looking to have a presentation from the process model group, as well as a discussion of at least an introduction to the recommendations, and then also the topic that, you know, I know only brought up briefly before, but, you know, it has, I think, come to the surface from a variety of ways, and that potentially one of the recommendations might center around having an integrated model, a federal data model that integrates clinical administrative data to help drive the work of the USCDI as well as what we're looking to accomplish. Because the whole goal is, when we look at the broader topic, is to capture data once and reuse it everywhere that needs to be. And in order to really do that, I mean, right now we're focusing on prior auths because that's been the current challenge. It's very burden intensive, but, you know, there could be a completely different way of operating here. And largely we haven't been able to really explore that because EMR systems are focused on, you know, what the providers need to provide clinical services, and claims administrative services are focused on payment. So maybe if we turn everything on its axis and say, what do we need if we have an integrated capability and the data that's needed can be available in some integrated way from day one, what would that drive and what would that data model look like? And maybe that's what we should be operating under. So we're going to try to explore some of those topics next week. And then further, we have a couple of other presentations coming up, one from EHRA, and then the schedule for the remainder of the summer is on this slide. I'm not going to go over every single thing. You've heard it numerous times before. But the most important thing, and let's go to the next slide, will be for members to really continue looking at the Google documents and provide some input and feedback and notes. Please don't change what's there, but you can certainly add to it and add comments. And if you have trouble getting those access to the Google Docs, please let the support team know, and we'll make that available. The recommendations work group is going to continue working, as well as the process model for that work to come back next week. And then, you know, the longer term that we just talked about. And we particularly today want to thank the representatives that we had, both from AHIMA and CAQH Core. I mean, AHIMA's presentation really focused on their ability to look at how to improve the quality of, you know, health records through the sharing of clinical data as they're looking at it, and really trying to come up with what are the triggers and then how can we fix this problem beyond automation, where the CAQH Core really focuses on their role as an industry standards group and really the recommendations that they're making available right now for adoption in the current hearing that we have coming up and the current standards commitment, and then the pilot work that they're doing, their new roadmap that uses steps approach in order to adopt some additional improvements and changes. And so all of these things will be very helpful to us as we are trying to build our current landscape and then recommendations and take into consideration, you know, all of the material that's brought forward to us through these important industry groups. We do have a few more minutes, so I'm going to ask if anyone else has any additional questions or comments that they would like to share. Please raise your hand now. Not seeing any. Alex, would you like to offer any final comments?
I encourage all the members to take a look at the Google Docs and get engaged. We will be looking forward to your active support in the writing exercise this summer.
Yes, we will. I second that. All right, well, seeing no hands raised, anything more from public comment?
There are no public comments.
All right, then I think that's a wrap. I think we can give you guys back a few more minutes in your day and say thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.